Le meilleur de Séances Radio est maintenant sur We Love Cinéma.
Tout de suite, retrouvez en direct le réalisateur Darren Aronofsky aux rencontres 7e art de Lausanne avec Flashback sur Séances Radio.
So let's welcome Darren Aronofsky. The discussion will be conducted by Benoît Roussel, who is a director and also a teacher here at ECAL. As you can hear, we can switch now in English or in Franglish, but if you don't speak English or are not really daring to speak in English, you can ask your question in French and then we will translate it to Mr. Darren Aronofsky. So feel free, if you want to ask question in English, in French, there is no problem. Benoît?
Merci.
Thank you very much for being here.
This is a weird couch. I feel awfully close to you.
Yeah. Okay.
I don't know how to sit, kind of, and go like this for a while. Sorry.
I don't know. I mean, the point is not to do analysis of your film, but throughout the way you work, it's maybe to understand more of what your cinema is about. And when you arrive on the set, what's important for you? What do you take care most precisely?
I mean, it changes through the day, but in the morning, it's always the same. We get to set, and usually pretty quickly I clear the set, and I just make the set just there for me and the actors. And we've already done a lot of rehearsing up at that point, but then we... And it's okay. Everyone here is a student, no? Students? So I'll be a little bit more technical and less entertaining. So we take the set and we'll work out the scene, and then I'll invite usually the cameraman and or camerawoman and the production designer and a few other department heads, and we'll perform the scene for them. And then the actors go off to hair and makeup and costume. And then usually the DP, the DOP controls the set and lights the set. And then eventually the actors come back and then there's always some fine tuning after that, but that's usually how we get the first shot off in the morning.
But how you do to make sure that during the moment you're filming, there is still something that takes place, that makes it new, or it's not like the real thing of something that has been done before?
I don't think that's ever a problem. I used to be afraid of that you could, you know, save it for the screen or save it for the camera, they used to say. I don't believe in that. I think actors are, you know, professionals, and that's their job to be able to create emotion. I mean, it might be a problem if you're working with beginner actors, which might be a bit of an issue if you're a student. But even so, I think having more rehearsal and trying things out is always interesting. I think sometimes when there's a really strong emotion that has to happen, you may want to be ready with a camera, because sometimes as soon as a character really lets the emotion out, it's hard to get something that strong again.
But is it something you did from the beginning, or you just decided to improve that rehearsal on these kind of things in your film? But in your first film, for example, when you were really a young filmmaker, did you have this idea to have a lot of rehearsal, to talk a lot with actor before going on the set, or is it something that you just discover film after film?
I guess it's evolved somewhat, but the method's probably very similar. You know, on the first film, our mutual friend Sean Gillette, who plays Max in P, was also came up with the story with me. So we spent a lot of time talking and thinking about it before we even ever got to set. So I don't know. I think it's really important to have a lot of conversation and a lot of trust with actors beforehand.
Even if the actor costs a lot of money and they ask you a lot of money to have rehearsal or things like that, is it different for this actor really well known? Sometimes they don't want to do that, or they have no time to do that before going on the set.
Well, it depends. I mean, you know, on Mother, we actually had 3-4 months of rehearsal, which probably no one's, very few films ever do that. And I kind of wanted to do that because Mother was a special case. You know, but then something like Noah, you get the actors 2 weeks beforehand. So you sort of have to do the best you can with, although that's not completely true because you cast the actors earlier. So even though they only show up at location 2 weeks before, there's usually a couple of months beforehand where you can have a lot of conversations with them and you're starting to get their focus.
What I like very much in your film, it's the ability that you create throughout the editing, throughout every visual effect also, to make the viewer take almost the place of the character. How do you manage to do that?
Well, it's one of the things I've been most fascinated about film and kind of how film is very different than theater is that, you know, in movies you can put an audience into the character's head. You can really give a subjective experience to an audience because you can enter what they're looking at, and you could also get really, really close to their faces so that you can feel their emotion. I've said a few times before that I think one of the most overlooked inventions of the 20th century is the close-up, which was an amazing sort of moment, I think, in human history because it allowed audiences to sort of see another person really up close without thinking about themselves, yet being able to sort of see very, very honest and open emotions. So that's kind of the power of cinema, is that you can show a kind of a pure, true story told through an actor's journey. Does that make sense?
But when you start, I mean, what's the starting point? You say, well, that's a story that can make sense to make a film out.
Usually starts with an idea or an image. Sometimes there's a story at the beginning, but there's usually an idea at the beginning before the story is there. There's usually something that's captivating that I can't get out of my head, that I sort of keep circling and adding things until you know it becomes more and more alive. I kind of described it earlier today as there's some famous thing about the blind man and the elephant, right? And he just feels the different parts of the elephant and he thinks it's different things. But it's similar with like a theme and a story. There's usually something invisible that you're circling that you want to tell, and only when you're about halfway done with the script do you actually realize what you're writing about.
Was it the case for Mother? Because the film is really conceptual. It's not only a story. There is a lot about symbolism on it. And even it's quite like an art piece. It's something like not really a film in the first way. When you read the script, for example, there is something really conceptual on it. Was it different for you working on this film and writing this film?
It was a very different process. What I was trying to do is... This is definitely not appropriate for children in a little bit.
But you're welcome to stay.
Well, I'm not responsible for the scars I might produce on your child's brain. I think I've always been very jealous of singer-songwriters and musicians because in a day or an afternoon they can create a song that becomes sort of, could represent a generation. You hear stories about Hey Jude written in an afternoon or something. And, you know, singer-songwriters get to do a very pure thing where they basically can put a single emotion into a song. And so I had an idea I had a feeling, and I wanted to see if I could really sort of capture that feeling quickly and execute it quickly and what would happen. So it was a very different process, and it came from a lot of different places. It was similar to maybe like Pi, which was everything I was thinking about at the time when I started to write Pi. And I think Mother also was, you know, I was thinking about my personal life, I was thinking about the political situation in the world, and I was thinking about a few other ideas, and they sort of all blended together to become something very different. And I wrote it very, very quickly. As soon as I had the idea, I couldn't really stop thinking about it. And I ended up writing it very, very, very quickly. And then it became about developing it after that. And it was different than other films because other films we usually waited till the script was really almost complete before we started building. I wanted to see if there was a way to take an idea and an emotion and make it as quick as possible.
Was it immediately, there is always immediately a link between the screenplay and the casting because there is the main characters, the two main characters really important in the film, in the, even the way they are looking and the fact that one of them is not an English speaker, a Spanish right. speaker. Is it something that you think immediately?
I think it always comes later. I don't think, the only time I ever really wrote something for an actor was when we worked on the script for The Wrestler and we knew Mickey Rourke was going to be in that. I think every other film, we don't necessarily know who's going to star in it. Actually, the other one would be, we knew Natalie Portman was going to do Black Swan, but mm-hmm. outside of that, you know, usually the actors I end up casting are not my first choice, so I never really perceive an actor when I'm writing. But then, you know, when Jennifer expressed interest in the project, it was just a really exciting possibility because she hadn't done anything like that before, and stretching her range was an exciting thing.
But it was not your first choice. You didn't think.
No, that's not true. No, that's not true.
What you said.
No. I never thought someone like her would want to do such a crazy movie.
But when you are writing, you don't have in mind an actor for this. No, never.
Never. Just I think the character always lives by itself, and then the actor always changes it and adds something to it.
But even a death actor, an actor from old time, for example, just to have this kind of actor in head as a model, never.
Okay. Never, no.
Well, there is some sequence, and we will see one just after, where actually we don't get exactly what's happening. It goes very fast, the editing is very quick, but it's close to experimental cinema.
Which movie?
I mean, it's in Requiem for a Dream. There is a sequence we will see after.
Take the baby out.
Maybe. Yeah, take the baby out now. We can see now the district now. Yeah. And then there is two students. We have a question
Please.
For you about this.
I'd love to talk to the students.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
Goddamn New York roofing niggers. Learn some manners.
Can you hear me? Can you see me?
Yes, sir.
Okay for work.
Mouth this.
Can you hear me? Can you see me?
Says he's got something wrong with his arm.
I don't think he'll be putting any more dope in that arm.
Smells worse than he did.
Test.
Better get him over to the hospital. I don't expect to live out the week.
Ready, and one.
Ready.
Thank you. Benoît, je passe la question aux étudiants. Ou...
I don't want to spoil the question of Lucas, who choose this short moment, but it's quite impressive to see it from here. And but there is things that we don't understand at the beginning, and then more and more it goes by the repetition, we get it. I mean, how much is it written in advance, this kind of moment or sequence?
I'm sure that was just written as it was. I don't really remember, but I'm sure it was written with small sentences about the different things and the intercutting. But I'm sure the intercutting is much more is a lot more in this. I think that just we spent a tremendous time in the edit room. We actually even the whole thing is cut so that the length of shots actually gets less and less and less, almost like a drum roll speeding up. And so we actually mathematically sat there with how many frames we could use and made it smaller and smaller. And it's pretty rhythmic in that way, just to sort of climax, you know.
Yes. So I was wondering, how do you manage like to see all this violence during the period of the editing, and how do you personally receive this violence?
Well, it's all make-believe, so we're not actually doing the violence or the sex. It's make-believe. So I'm usually looking at how to make it not look make-believe and look real. So I'm trying to make it more intense usually, but it doesn't... You don't really live with it in that way, in the same way that the emotion that the audience that sees it for the first time feels. I think about that a lot to sort of, because that's my job, is to feel like the audience as much as possible and to absorb. You know, I have to constantly keep reminding myself to put myself in your shoes. But, you know, the images by themselves are not, they're not violent or sexual in any way, because I know how they were created. I was there, and on set that's not happening. So
is it something that it was written on the script, this sequence, or something that you decided when you was editing the film? And
which
how
part?
Was it this part that we just saw now?
I mean,
all this montage sequence with
all of it's scripted.
In the same way, with a storyboard or really written?
Oh, you mean like a shot? I don't think this was deeply storyboarded. I'm sure I did some storyboard work, because I used to do a lot more storyboard work back then. But I'm sure it was all shot listed, meaning I knew every shot I had to get and basically where I was going to stick the camera before the day started. You know, but that changes sometimes when you get to set and you see, you know, if there's a machine in the way that you can't move, like the scene with Marlon where he's cooking in the kitchen. There was tons of different machinery and stuff, and so we had to work around that stuff. You know, and then I think the scene with Marion was much more documentary style. We sort of created a scenario, and there were a lot of non-actors there, so we had to create that setting. And then something like Jared and Ellen, who both are doing very physical things, like Ellen has to do the shock stuff, and she was probably 70 at that time, or 69 at the time she did that. And so that was very, maybe she was younger. I can't remember how old she was, but still we had to make sure she was safe. And so it was all very, very deeply figured out and because, careful.
Because it's something that happen often in your film, the fact that there is a kind of montage sequence, something really strong, violent or not, but with a lot of feelings on it. How you can write that? In which way are you explaining that in a screenplay? Because it gives me the feeling that it's a kind of solution that you have when you were editing the film to break something in the process of telling the stories. But when you have to write this kind of sequence, because a lot of students are not working on screenplay, how you do that?
I mean, you try to capture the mood a bit, but you recognize that you're not going to know how all the cuts are going to work until you get into the edit room, because you don't know what the different real emotions that an actor is going to give you in extreme situations like that. So you have to remain open to that type of work. It's okay, little baby.
But what you say also for a sequence like this one, I mean, it's kind of a musical, visual musical thinking or visual musical editing, and you work with the sound, the stories, the remaining images, and then the movement, everything is kind of a cooking that's take place in the editing room.
Yeah, I mean, it does start at the screenplay phase, and then it then when you're shooting it, you're thinking about certain things, how certain shots will hand off to other shots. And then, you know, with this sequence, there was a lot of manipulation in the edit room. I mean, another good example would be The Fountain, which was combining three different time periods. But the way we did a lot of those transitions were really thought out. So that restricted us for where we would come from and where we would go. But, we were able to manipulate it a bit, you know. Or something like Mother is kind of one continuous idea. So there was very little cutting we could do in that film, and we had to figure out other ways to sort of manipulate the speed and the tempo of it.
You've been doing some films with a few money and some with big budget. What have you learned from the big budget and from the film with less money?
There's really no difference. There's always never enough money.
Could you just explain how you finance your first film? Because it's really something interesting for students there.
Yeah.
How you find the money for your first
film. Well, it's not that interesting anymore because you guys have Kickstarter.
Yes, that's right.
Before Kickstarter, we came up with the idea of crowdsourcing, but with, you know, letters where we actually sent them through the mail because it was before email. So we actually sent letters to every person we knew and asked them for $100 each with the promise they would get $150 back if the film made money. And, you know, I think no one thought they were going to get the $150 check back. So signing those checks was a really good memory, you know.
Did you have some nostalgia of this time, or not really? The fact to be your own producer, to be more free, because when you don't have money...
I have nostalgia for every moment but this present moment right now.
Okay.
No, just kidding. But I will have nostalgia for it in a couple of hours.
But still, I mean, even if there is not enough money, never enough money... What do you like from those restrictions? I mean, do you, because there is not enough money, have to invent something that was not
always
there?
I mean, that's why it's good not to have enough money. Because if you have enough money, you're fucked, you know. And it won't be a good film. The restrictions and the boundaries is where creativity begins. So unless you know the box that you're working in, you don't really know how to work. So as soon as you can figure out what that box looks like, the more creative you can be.
But for example, when you have a big budget, what do you push more?
Everything. I mean, everything. It's all, usually it's time, because you want more time with the actors to create stuff. And then, I mean, the big budget film was Noah. It was about... there were all types of, you know, how much rain could we afford? How many extras can we afford? How big are the special effects? So you're always pushing everything to make it as fantastic as you can. Should we get a question?
Do you have if someone have a question, just raise your hand. I would go there.
Oh, it's good to see him run, huh?
Why do you say that? I'm too
Sorry.
Fat.
Just because you're the big boss.
Okay.
Thank you for being here. I'm super excited because you're one of my big inspirations for studying film, actually. And I wanted to ask, how was the writing process in the beginning for you? When we were starting out, was there a lot of self-doubt involved, or how did you manage to actually bring it to the end?
There's still self-doubt every day, you know. So I think it's important to have self-doubt because it makes you work harder. You know, I think you just keep... I think self-doubt's a good thing. You know, I think once you lose that, you're in trouble. And so you should constantly be questioning why you're making certain decisions. For me, writing is always a hard job. you know, I like the collaboration when you sort of daydream with friends about what the story can be. And I usually have to do a lot of that. I spend a lot of time with different friends talking about the story. And then eventually I research it so much and I think about it so much that it becomes time to write. And that's usually very lonely time because you mostly write alone, or at least I do. And I like those comedy writers who can sit in a room and just hit jokes back and forth to each other. I've never seen it, but that's my imagination about them. But you know, when you write these films, I'm often alone, and then it's hard and it's lonely, and then but it feels good when you get through it. One of the best pieces of advice about writing I've read is Lucas said to Coppola, vice versa, that once you start, you got to get to the end and don't go back too much. And I think for me, it's more like screenwriting is more like sculpture than any other type of writing because it's very structural, telling stories for movies. And it's important not to, if you were making a sculpture of a person and you focused on the hand at way too much time, then usually the hand will be bigger and more detailed and kind of, you sort of want to slowly take away at the piece of clay or marble that you're working on layer by layer by layer, so that the end and the middle are as good as the beginning. So, and it takes many passes. Just, I mean, if you look in my hard drive, there's probably 50, 60 passes at Mother, you know, and similar on every film.
What do you do, for example, when you think you reach a stage where the script is maybe good enough to do something? I mean, do you read it in front of people? Do you make other people read it? What kind of exchange do you have to know how far, how good it is?
Well, I think people are reading the script throughout. You have hopefully a trusted team that's slowly reading it and giving you good feedback and notes.
But regularly?
Yeah, I think when you get to a certain stage, usually it's the same thing in the editing phase. I don't want people to see the film or to read the script until I'm not really sure what I'm going to do next. And then usually that getting other people to look at it shakes some ideas up and you go, oh yeah, you know, that's a new perspective.
Hello. I would be interested in the mood on a set and how does it feels like to shoot such a violent scene. And like you said, you're actually pretending to shoot some violence, but what kind of appointment do you make with the actors to keep their intimacy and so on?
Well, I mean, it's usually very calm on set, you know, because things are only happening between action and cut. Sometimes that's different. You know, when we did The Wrestler, we stuck Mickey, you know, backstage and on stage, in the ring, in front of real audiences at real promotions with real wrestlers. So that had a real energy to it. It was almost like probably what it feels like to shoot a concert film, because there was a concert going on, yet we were sticking our actor in the middle of it. You still try to keep everyone calm, but it has a different type of adrenaline because there is a certain unknowing of what's going to happen and how it's all going to land, the physics. But usually in all of the stuff you saw in Requiem, it's a very controlled, you know, set where everyone's only acting between action and cut, and the rest of the time, you know, everyone's joking around, or some actors will withdraw and stay serious and want to stay in it. Other actors will just want to, you know, talk and hang out.
I have a question about the scores, the musical scores in your movies, because your movies are also very famous. The scores of the movies are very famous, and of course Clint Mansell, but also Tchaikovsky. It's very important in your movies. But in your very last movies, Mother, you completely removed the musical scores, and you removed it because I read that you hired a composer, but in the final movie there was no music. And I found it very powerful, and would you say it's an evolution to remove the musical component?
I mean, there was a. I worked for 7 months with Johan Johansson on the score for Mother, and we worked very closely together, and the music was awesome. We actually even recorded a bunch of it. But there was something really weird. Whenever you put music in the scene, something went off the... Something wasn't working. And we tried a lot of different things, and we couldn't figure it out. And I think what we realized is... and what I was trying to do with Mother was to tell a movie completely from one character's point of view. So in the case, of, I wanted to tell Mother's point of view and just her point of view. Yet in the film, she is always wondering what's going on. And as soon as you put music into a scene, you're telling the audience what to feel. Music is like such a secret tool by filmmakers to manipulate the audience. You can, you know, very, very easily make an audience feel something. But I didn't want the audience to know what to feel in the movie. I wanted them to be leaning in to see what the actor was doing and trying to figure out, like she is, what's going on. And so every time we put music, it just it fell apart.
But maybe sometimes music is what the film is thinking. You are saying something in the film, but sometimes music can be the subconscious of the film in a way.
Yeah.
Is it something that you didn't want in this scene particularly?
I didn't want the audience to have any idea. I wanted the audience to figure out with her what was going on. I didn't want to give them any clues. I wanted Jennifer to be the only person supplying evidence of what she was feeling. But because I wanted to put the audience for 2 hours into her head. You know, except for the first scene and the last scene, which is from Javier Bardem's point of view, the entire movie, you're over her shoulder or on her face. That's it. There's no wide shots. It's just those two shots. And that was just, that was my box. You know, it's interesting. I had less financial limitations on that film, but how I controlled it was just by having two shots in the film, which is over her shoulder and her face, so that I was limited where I could, how I can shoot it. And that created incredible difficulty and limitations.
What you just said about Mother and what you said just before about the wrestler, I mean, it's very close also to documentary. I mean, to catch something that takes place just in front of the camera. I mean, yeah. What the setting of this fight events, and also this situation in the house. Is it something you're familiar with? I mean, is it something you look for?
I mean, my first training when I first started studying filmmaking, it came from like a cinema verite place. So I think that was a big influence. I think I got away from it, you know, doing Pi and Requiem and The Fountain. And then when I started to work on The Wrestler, I realized that Mickey was such a fascinating character that almost making a documentary on Mickey Rourke playing The Wrestler was a good movie. So it was kind of like I let Mickey, that wasn't Mickey's hair, that wasn't his wardrobe, you know, he hates wrestling, but I was able to sort of, you know, put his personality front and center and let him be who he is, and then sort of create a fiction around it. But like we did complete documentary in that, like we went into a supermarket, a tiny, tiny crew, and we couldn't afford extras, so we had real people coming over and ordering meat. And Mickey would, you know, without gloves and just his dirty hands, would be cutting the meat and then writing a random price on it. And at one point, a PA came to me and was like, you know, these people are going and they're buying the meat. And I was like, you know what, that's probably a bad idea because it's not sanitary and I don't, so we should probably intercept them and take the meat back from them and or something. But all of that, like all those people in the deli counter are half of them are real people. And that was fun. That was, and it was good, I think, for Mickey because he has such an incredible personality. He just can hang out and talk to anyone. And we sort of captured that part of it and that became part of The Wrestler. I think Mother was completely constructed. Everything, even though it has that same kind of verite feeling, every single moment was constructed and created in front of her.
We were talking about budget. Where do you cut at first? Can we hire people for free to work in a film?
Well, I've never done anything for free, and I don't recommend it. And I mean, there were times we didn't pay people, but like on Pi, 50% of the back end of that movie went to the investors, and the other 50% was split evenly amongst all the filmmakers. So I own as much as the guy who held the boom on Pi. We all got like 1 or 2 points of it because it was like a 25, 26 person. So it was a very kind of socialistic approach because I couldn't afford to pay people. I probably should have borrowed money because I would have made a lot more money. But it's funny because we still get checks from Pi and we still write, I don't know, 50, 60 checks and mail them out to people. And so people are still making money off of that movie. And it was cool because like certain people, once again, this was Facebook. So there were people that we lost touch with and we just kept their money in a bank account building up. And then we found like one, the guy who's the gaffer was living in Japan for years. And then suddenly he got a big check and it changed his life. And it started crying to me on the phone. So, you know, beautiful things like that happen, you know.
I think there is the opportunity now to look at another extract of...
What is it?
Black Swan.
One of your films.
Yeah, it will be a surprise.
Black Swan.
Okay.
Something from you.
Okay.
I hope so. There's a question from Luca, is it right? Luca URL? No? Yeah, okay, just a second. Do you like that watch again your film, or is it something painful for you?
Somewhere in between.
Between really painful or a little bit pleasant?
Yeah, I don't know. It's very strange. It's kind of like masturbation.
Yeah, a quick one, a question. What's the point for you of showing violence in a scene, for example?
Well, I think you have to be responsible. I think, especially in American cinema, violence is not treated with respect. In fact, it's all turned around in American cinema, where violence is sort of fetishized and sex, you know, is kind of shunned. So. I kind of try to flip that and always show violence for what it really is. And so that's kind of my attitude towards it.
But in this scene, just before I will give you the mic, but in this scene, there is something really dramatic about the music, about the ballet itself.
It's called Tchaikovsky.
Yeah. What you can add about that with film? Is it not really a little bit dangerous to try to make something more dramatic than what ballet is dramatic itself? There is a danger in this kind of scene for you as a director not to make to be less dramatic than the situation itself when you have to film it.
I never go that way. I always...
You try.
I always push right into the extremes. I like the extremes. I mean, I think that's the fun part about movies is when they really go for it and it gets really crazy. I like to be swept up when I see films. So that's always been my goal is to... lean into the craziness. It's funny, this scene was always, when you talked about how did these films start, there was always this, I always knew this piece of music would end the film mm-hmm. because it ends the ballet. And so I had listened to it over and over again. And I can remember when we were struggling to get money for the movie, pitching this with a little, with the music on the phone, playing it back at people and me describing what they would see.
So you would actually tell the story and at the same
just that part, I'd be like, this is how it ends, and she stabs herself and this is coming and she's dancing the final thing and she leaps into oblivion and anyway, that didn't really work, the pitch, but I was conceiving it for a very, very long time with this, you know, with the music, so you know, to see it come to life is very cool.
I mean, there is something very curious. I mean, On few of your films, the character, the main character, would fall down at the end. I mean, there is that in this scene, which I've seen at the end of Requiem for a Dream.
In all of them.
In all of them, okay. And it's also...
They all have the same ending, but if you look closely, except for one. Does anyone know which one has a different ending? Yeah.
Hello?
But, yeah. He's not answering that question. There's one that doesn't have the ending. It's not my fault.
But tell us.
Yeah, that's right. No, because I couldn't, you know, the Bible has a happy ending. So I was like, I couldn't really change that. But believe me, I would have if I could have.
But there is something that happened to us as viewers. I mean, we are so much involved in the film. I mean, throughout the sound, the editing. And I like very much the Fontaine also for the kind of attraction we are. It's almost like you're really in a film. I mean, it makes sense to look at the film in a movie theater and not on a mobile phone. And then when it's over, it's like we all fall down. I mean, it's like the lights goes up and it's over. It's we are more alive during the moment we watch the film than when the lights come. It's the light back. Right.
Merci.
Hello. Just wanted to ask, when you shoot a scene or a movie, do you always manage to convey the message you wanted to convey in the first place when you wrote it? Or do you sometimes get frustrated because you're not able to make your ideas come to life? And how do you deal with it, if it ever happened?
Yeah, I mean, so far I've been able to finish the films how I've wanted to finish them. You know, there's always certain things that you could want to change that you can't, but I've been very lucky and I guess tenacious in holding on to make sure that they all get to the finish line how I want. And then of course there's people that see it the way you want to see it, and there's people that don't see it the way you want to see it. And sometimes that those things align more and sometimes they align less, and there's nothing you can do with it. As long as you in the moment worked as hard as you could, then there's really no regrets. You just sort of say, okay, I did my best, and to me, that was the best that I could do, and, you know, that's all you can
usually
do.
Usually you're satisfied with your work every time, like, you finish a movie,
I mean,
you're satisfied with it.
I mean, I don't know if satisfaction is the thing. Yeah. Sometimes it's exhaustion.
Yeah.
It's a different... They end differently. It's not always... I don't think it's ever satisfaction. It's, but you sort of feel when it's done, you know. The one that I couldn't let go was The Fountain for a while, but the whole point of The Fountain is about letting go and finishing it. You know, he's supposed to finish the book, and he never finishes the book. So, but I have now finished it, and I've let it go. But for a long time, I just kept holding on to it. And that was that's just a waste of time. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know what the feeling is at the end. You just sort of feel that it's over, and then it represents that kind of chapter in your creative life.
I am interested in who is your favorite actor and actress?
Ever or that I worked with?
Yeah.
Which, yeah.
Your favorite movie.
That I've worked with or in the history of the world?
In the world.
In the world. you're a filmmaker, right?
Yeah.
So why are you asking me a stupid question?
Why is it stupid?
Sorry, was that rude? He's a friend. I just met him today. So, no, but I mean, you can't really do a favorite film. You can't really say a favorite film. You know, there's so many great movies, you know, and they're different. And they're great in different ways. And I feel the same way about actors. But, probably I would have liked to work with Toshirô Mifune, the Japanese actor from Kurosawa. If I had to bring someone back, I would love to work with Marlon Brando. I'd like to work with Meryl Streep. That's possible. But I don't know. You know, Katharine Hepburn would have been great to work with.
Hi. Talking about movies, do you usually watch movies, or for you it's a way that would block your imagination, creativity?
No. You watch as much movies as you can.
Yeah, that's what I do too.
Yeah, no, I watched Revolution today, the Al Pacino movie, which was great. And I just try to, you're constantly watching movies trying to be inspired.
Have you ever seen Bullhead, Belgian movie?
Yeah, of course.
It really reminds me of your work.
Oh, cool.
What kind of relation you have with European cinema, for example?
Sorry?
What kind of relation you have with European cinema? Do you see a lot of European films?
Yeah, of course.
What kind of film?
I didn't grow up with that much European cinema, but because it wasn't really possible in America when I was a kid. It wasn't really, it was hard to seek out, especially where I was from in New York City, which was the outer part of New York City. So we didn't really have art theaters or European theaters. We did eventually get videotape, and there was a lot of interesting stuff there. And so when I started to get into filmmaking, you know, I stumbled on Fellini, and then I watched everything he did first on videotape before I was able to see it on film. I did different. I have long relationships with most of the European masters. That just over several years, I got addicted to them.
Because generally, you know, we always like something which is really far away from you. For my generation, for example, New Hollywood was really something important, and because it was from America and really different from film we are making there.
Right.
But for you as an American, what is your connection with New Hollywood and film were shown there, all this period of American cinema? Do you feel a connection between you and them, or it's something totally different?
I think
for you?
There's a connection between the independent film movement of the 90s, which I think I'm part of, and the New Hollywood to a certain extent. Like New Hollywood was, you know, rebelling against you know, the big musical studio films, and they were returning to realism, influenced a lot by European filmmakers, actually. And then I think then there was a big sort of popcorn, you know, blockbuster movement of the 80s. Mm-hmm. And I think the independent film movement was sort of a reaction to that. And now you look at the Academy Awards this year, and it's all kind of independent films that are the biggest films. So...
But you feel more, from outside, you feel more alone today, you as a filmmaker in American film industry, because in those times, there is a bunch of filmmakers. We have the feeling that they were working together or they knew each other. When we are watching your, following your career, we have the feeling that you are more alone, a little bit lost in the American film industry.
Well, thank you.
No, is it? Maybe it's a good thing, but
no, I disagree. I mean, you know, I look up to filmmakers like Wes Anderson and P.T. Anderson and Spike Lee, and I think there's a lot of filmmakers who are making independent-minded. You know, Soderbergh is in that.
But you're connected to the guys. You talk together a lot. Is it your friends or not really?
Well, when we see each other, we're friendly.
Yeah, friendly. That's not your friend.
But I think all of us have our own lives, and we're, you know, do our own thing. No, I don't think it's. It feels like that was really a movement and a club. I don't know if we have something similar. Although I don't know. I think like Quentin and Rodriguez are really good friends, they have a friendship.
But is it something you are nostalgic of? This kind of strong feeling of brotherhood in the 70s from filmmakers, as I don't know, Joe Dante or John Landis, people like that, working together or knowing each other.
It would be nice to have more friends, but I don't know.
But not really in the film industry.
No. I yeah. I don't know. I mean, I moved away from Los Angeles to get away from everyone talking about movies.
So it's something you decide.
I try to surround myself with people that don't talk about movies as much as possible so that I have other ideas and other information comes in.
And maybe you are more connected with the art world or something like that.
No.
No, not really.
A little bit.
Give a feeling when we are watching your film. There is something really plastic on it.
Yeah. Oof.
Hi, Darren. Thank you so much for being here. I'm such a great fan of your work. Could you talk a bit more about when you were starting out as a young filmmaker and how you defined your own style? Did you try to limit yourself into one kind of theme, like self-destruction, how you actually evolved your style throughout the years and you didn't limit yourself to one specific style?
I mean, I hope that every movie has its own language and that your job as a film director is to figure out that language. You look at the story, you think about it thematically, and then you look at your resources and what you actually can pull off. And you try to create a film language and a film grammar that becomes a limited language. Because, you know, you can put the camera anywhere. And in today's world, you really can put it anywhere. With a drone, you could stick it on the ceiling. The possibility of what you can do is endless. So it's really important to figure out how you're going to tell a story and which tools you're going to use. So I think, you know, Pi came out of, you know, being in film school for a couple of years and not having a lot of time to make projects and having a limited access to equipment. So, I learned very quickly that moving the camera cost you a lot of time. So I tried to figure out ways of shooting things from one angle and take advantage of that angle with as many things. And I think that sort of led to a whole sort of language. You know, the quick hip-hop montage cutting stuff was just a quick way of sort of relating a lot of story across to an audience that was not expensive to do because we were shooting really tiny things, so we could do it in a really small space. So I think a lot of the early stylistic stuff came out of limitations of resources, and so we had to be clever in what we decided. I mean, we shot black and white on Pi. It was actually more expensive to shoot black and white, but I didn't think we had enough money to execute a sci-fi kind of trippy movie in color. Like, I thought to do that, we would have had to control a lot of things in the palette, and that would just be very expensive. And I knew once we went to black and white, everything would be instantly stylized. And then I took it a step further and more difficult and did black and white reversal, which is a type of film that everything either goes completely black or white. There's very little gray tone. And so it just immediately became very, very different looking and stylized. And that was, even though it cost more expensive to develop the film, that was cheaper than actually trying to execute something that contained visually. And then just, you know, The Wrestler would be a different thing where, like, I knew Mickey isn't at his best when he has to hit a piece of tape on the floor. So I decided to figure out a way of shooting it where he could go anywhere he wanted to and the camera would be ready for it. So I hired the operator, actually, of that film comes from news and was a cameraman for news. So he was very good at just, you know, being everywhere all the time. And so Mickey could do anything. And so that's where that kind of handheld cinema verite style started.
I have just a question because you work with so famous actors and you talked about The Wrestler and that Mickey was fighting a professional wrestler. And I was wondering, how did you approach the work with non-actors?
I mean, it's difficult. Non-actors are always hard. And, it depends on what they have to do. You know, in The Fountain, while doing research, we had this incredible brain surgeon who was coaching Rachel Weisz and Hugh Jackman on what brain surgery was like and what happens to families when someone's dying. And he was an incredible, beautiful soul. And I asked him to be, you know, in the movie. And on the day of the shoot, you know, he came out and he was awful. And every time he opened his mouth, I saw his wife, who was his nurse, mouthing the words with him. And I realized that they had been up all night practicing the lines, and I could never get this guy to relax. He was so nervous. So the message is, don't hire a neurosurgeon to play a neurosurgeon. And so we last minute had to find another actor to come in and cover us. And if you notice, when you see the movie, his doctor's shirt is really big on him because he was a little guy and we only had it in big size. So that was a disaster. And I did the same thing in Mother. I wrote one of the extras for a friend of mine who's, you know, doesn't do this. And he had to do a scene with Jennifer Lawrence. And she just, the second he started to act, I realized she was just destroying him because I put my friend against one of the best actors in the world. And it was just humiliating. So I pulled him aside. I said, there's good news and bad news, which you want to hear? And he said, I'll hear the bad news. I said, well, actually, they're the same. You're not an actor. And so I sent him home and I brought in a real actor to do it. So, you know, I the only thing I would do with non-actors is things where they can easily get lost in the activity that's in front of them. That's the only way I would work with non-actors, is that they're actually doing something that they know how to do. So if you have a carpenter, if he's building a shelf, that's great. If he has to say a line while he's building the shelf, that you may run into trouble.
Hello. I would like to ask, as a director, you have an idea of where you want to go. And I was wondering, how do you collaborate? Because you have to deal with a lot of people and maybe they have input. So either you don't disregard their input and you go to where you want to go, or you are the type of person who can incorporate input from whoever around. And if so, how do you do it? Could you give us an example?
It's called better or different. If the idea is better, you take it. If it's different, it's my choice. You know, so that's what you have to sort of say. You welcome ideas. You totally want ideas. You know, sometimes sound person or gaffer, someone, you know, that's usually, because I encourage it on my set, they'll come up to me and they'll say, hey, you know, maybe this will. And you're like, oh, that's great. And usually the ideas that come to you, they come from super experienced artists and artisans that have been doing this for years and know tricks that you just may have never done. I mean, a lot of the thing as a director is you're on set once every couple of years. A lot of these people are back-to-back-to-back-to-back productions. I mean, I don't know how they do it. They finish with me, and then on Monday, they start a new production. It's terrifying because I'm so exhausted by the end of a shoot. I don't know how they do it. So there's a lot of experience there, so you want to welcome it. But you just have to be able to analyze really quickly if it's a better idea or a different idea.
I think we have to close, but I want to ask you a last question. I mean, do you have an example of a very lucky accident that took place during the shooting, something you did not expect, and that becomes something very interesting for the film?
I'm sure there is. Usually, I mean, the first thing that popped in my head is an accident that happens with an actor, an emotion that you don't expect. And there was a lot of that in Mother with Jennifer. She would have incredible emotions that I've never seen before that I didn't know a person could do. And that was exciting. And then you would follow that and see where that path went. I'm trying to think. There's probably so many accidents, and the second we finish this, I'll think of a lot of them. But nothing's really popping into my head. But that is definitely part of the process. Is things rarely go exactly how you're planning them, and then when you get to set, you have to sort of be very truthful and honest to what's happening in front of you. And if it's not, and this goes back to your question. If it's not working out the way you want it to, which happens a lot, you have to sort of see what's happening in front of you and make the best of it. And that's almost all the time, because it's usually there's a problem with getting the camera in the right place because the camera can't move that quickly. So how do I make it, you know, how do I make this limitation into something interesting?
Thank you, Darren.
Thank you, everybody. So merci beaucoup.
Merci.
Bonjour, c'est Vincent Pérez. N'hésitez pas à suivre les rencontres 7e art Lausanne sur Séance Radio.
Les rencontres 7e art Lausanne, suivez le programme et connectez-vous à Séance Radio.
Retrouvez l'ensemble des contenus Séance Radio proposés par We Love Cinéma sur tous vos agrégateurs de podcasts.